That river is both boundary and horizon.
The Mississippi has meant a lot of things to a lot of different people over the years. Before the Civil War, if you were an escaping slave, it could be the route to freedom, or literally, a dead end.
As you stand here on the Missouri side and you look across, and you can see Illinois very clearly, you know, it's less than a mile away. If you were a slave on the Missouri side, you could longingly spend your entire life looking across to the promised land, literally. But how do you get across it?
This is Angie DeSilva. She's a historian of slavery who does a lot of her teaching outside the classroom. She's a professor by day and also a slave reenactor. And she likes bringing people to this historic spot on the Mississippi. It's a place called the Mary Meacham Freedom Crossing, just a few miles from downtown St. Louis. It commemorates an early Black activist on the Underground Railroad and a celebrated, though ill-fated, crossing.
May 21st, 1855, 9 slaves belonging to prominent St. Louisans met with Mary Meacham at the Bissell Ferry Landing at Blue O'Clock in the Morning. Now, Blue O'Clock in the Morning is a very old-fashioned term for the deepest part of night. This is like 3 and 4 a.m. when there's absolutely no light. And they were told to meet there. Now, the Bissell Ferry Crossing was the farmer's crossing into Illinois. If I had a load of pigs or a load of hay or something that needed to get across the river, I didn't take that downtown to the passenger porch, but crossed up here at Bissell Ferry. And that night, when the skiff arrived to pick them up, it was piloted by a free Black man by the name of Freeman. And the skiff was very small. I don't think he expected that many slaves to be there. There were 9 waiting to get across the river. They had been told once they got to the Illinois shore, there was a small Black community called Venice, Illinois, and they were told to skirt the village and to run to the plank road on the other side of the village in the tree line. That's where the wagons would be waiting. When the first load of 5 slaves hits the Illinois shore, they start running as they were told. But what they didn't know is their plan had been found out. The sheriff of St. Louis, some of the owners and deputies were lying in ambush. The ambush is sprung. They start shooting at these slaves, trying to force them back to the river. And what the sheriff didn't know is that the 4 slaves on the Missouri side were watching all of this. He thought he had everybody. When the events of the night are over, 5 slaves are recaptured and 4 do get away. This is when Mary Meacham is given up, whether torture or whatever means. She is arrested that night and put under house arrest. Now, one of the consequences for free Blacks helping slaves escape is that they were often enslaved themselves. So this, you know, she risked her freedom. It gives you some kind of key into the character of this woman.
Angie DeSilva collects stories like these, stories of Civil War-era Black activists and their resistance to slavery. And the thing is, there are hundreds. It bothers Angie that they aren't better known, because she says their absence from history books perpetuates the myth of Black people as victims.
That is not true. And we have Mary Meacham as this prime example. And you could talk about John Parker on the Ohio River, who every single night, and the man, you know, ran a foundry. He was well-to-do, sent his daughters to college. But every night, John Parker, after working on his feet all day, would row up and down the Ohio River with a certain call, seeing if there were Blacks trying to cross from Kentucky into Ohio. We would imagine that Freeman, the man coming down from Alton to St. Louis, was doing the same thing. Okay, these are people that took a stand, that got involved. And so, you know, to me, the civil rights movement didn't start in the 1960s. It started in the 1860s. You know, people just dug in. And so after the Civil War, their focus is assimilation. We now have to help these people survive. And so what we see is the rise of Black lodges. And this is an aspect of Black history that has just not been focused on.
What were the Black lodges?
Well, they were fraternal organizations. And I'll give you the biggest one. Everybody always talks about the Masons, the Masonic lodges.
Mm-hmm. Was it like that?
It was. The one I'm going to tell you about, A, was the biggest, and B, it was infinitely more practical, okay? The UBF, United Brothers of Friendship. It was enslaved and free men before the Civil War who got together and functioned as guides in the Underground Railroad. After the Civil War, they too saw a need to help that assimilation. Not only was it to read and to write, but for the women, how to make clothes, how to, do a lot of things that we would assume people knew how to do. And of course, this is another reason why. There were a lot of Black orphans. There were a lot of displaced Blacks after the Civil War, and some of these plantations, when they couldn't use them anymore, use is in the is in a very negative term, mm-hmm. Turn them out just like cattle. Get off my land. I don't need you anymore. Bye. Okay.
Well, it sounds like the Black lodges were essentially functioning as kind of halfway houses to help formerly enslaved peoples recover.
That is exactly right. So the United Brothers of Friendship will grow and grow and grow, and to the point where around the turn of the century in Texas and here, they will actually have orphanages and old folks' homes. Again, if you were a slave that, had been severely misused physically, you broke down pretty early. And if you didn't have anybody to take care of you, this is what happened.
Getting back to the river, though, we were sort of starting to paint the picture of Mary Meacham and this historic rescue, and then postbellum, the development of these Black lodges, but also the first freed Black communities kind of up and down the river. I guess I'm wondering why the river?
St. Louis will become, around 1860, the third largest inland water port. The goods and services that made that happen was on the backs of Black labor. The roustabouts, slave and free, who were moving tonnage and tonnage and tonnage daily, weekly, offloading, loading, unloading, loading, keeping commerce moving. We are truly the gateway to the West. And so what happens is the migration of Blacks out of Mississippi is definitely, when you talk about the Deep South, is straight up the river. It was the fastest way to get there, and it was the safest way. To tell you the truth, you wouldn't want to be a Black person on your own at any point trying to traverse through small towns all the way from Mississippi to St. Louis. And especially, in the 1880s, 1890s, when Black people are kidnapped and pressed into service in fields, because it's cotton picking time.
Did anything equivalent happen along the river? Was there a river-based equivalent of sharecropping, for instance?
I can only tell you about the branches of my family that were along the river. In New Haven, Missouri, after the Civil War, we had a branch of the family that lived there. And after the Civil War, this Black community created a barge to be able to go back and forth across the river. They became quite prosperous. And because of that, whites burnt the ferry and would not allow them to reactivate it. There were different types of laws here in the Upper South that you didn't necessarily have any place else. For example, we had an incredible amount of sundown towns here. And we are talking about from the 1870s to the 1950s.
Sundown towns?
Yes, ma'am. These are towns, Washington, Missouri on the river, New Haven. A lot of these towns were sundown towns. They would have signs. Once you're, coming into town, inward, you need to be out of town by 6. Okay, this was the sign that greeted you coming in town. There were sundown towns that later was a siren, but it would be a bell citywide telling Blacks, it is time for you to get out of town.
Where did they go?
They went home, out of town. I mean, even here, before slavery was over, if I'm a free black person and I can't get off the street by then, I would probably sign myself into Bernard M. Lynch's slave pen, where he would charge me a dollar, quote, room and board, unquote, which meant a drink of water. But the whole thing is, I'm not on the street because curfew violation is 39 lashes. Now, do you understand the inherent risk of that? You are turning yourself into a slave dealer.
A slave
dealer. To avoid 39 lashes. I mean, again,
you just hope he's going to let you out again the next day.
Bingo. There you go. But this is the way it was.
I guess I want to ask you about the work of historical imagination, because, you know, besides the kind of stories you've been telling us, you also are a slave reenactor. And there's a particular character that you play a lot, Lila, you've developed. Can you tell me about Lila and that whole process of creating a historical character?
When I was 10, my mother died, and my grandmother came to live with us, and she was ancient then. And being around her all day, she would tell me about her grandmother. And her grandmother had been a slave here in Missouri. And my grandmother would tell me stories that her grandmother had told her about slavery. And it resonated with me as a small child even then. Then when I got into high school, I realized, taking Black history classes, that my grandmother was the last living link, literally, to 250 years of this country's history. The last living link. And so her words became even more precious to me. And then after, you know, through college and, you know, and being able to pursue this interest, the WPA slave narratives, I became just, just immersed in them. And these people's lives and in their voices. But I also realized their voices have never been heard. Mm-hmm. You know, these stories, people don't read. People have never read them or might even be aware of them. So Lila is part of that. She's giving voice to those thousands and thousands of Black women.
Is she based on any of your grandmother's stories about her grandmother?
Well, she talked about... technically, her master, needless to say, was also her father. And so it was more like the work and the food, because Isabel worked in the house. But she also, during times of planting and harvesting, worked in the fields like everybody else did. Even the house slaves went out. But my grandma, it was little things. It was like stories that she told and how, for example, most slave women smoked a pipe. And so Lila, as I'm telling my story, I'm smoking a pipe. Now, some people, and they stare at that, not understanding that these people, this is how they relaxed. Terrible things happen to Lila, but she doesn't give in to them. And the ultimate form of resistance, of course, is she's on that riverbank that night in 1855.
Lila's one of those who goes with Mary Meacham?
Yeah. There was a middle-aged woman that nobody really knew who she was. So I can place her there, but I have to give her a backstory. And so we see everything that's happened to her up to that day and how a woman who is already, you know, in her declining years, will decide that she's not going to die in that state of unfree. And she's willing to risk it all to be on that bank, to go into that darkness, into that tumultuous river. It's her final act. Either she's going to make it or she's not.
So I have to ask, you can tell that story, tell that history as you do professionally as a teacher and a historian. It's another thing entirely to embody it, to become Lila, to take part in a reenacted slave auction on the steps of the St. Louis courthouse, which you did. What does that do for you personally? How does that change you?
You know what? My grandmother, you know, there's this saying about that people, when they first got free, my people don't want me to talk about it. That second generation after slavery, they didn't hear about it. This was the dark night of their soul, and they did not want to hear about it. So it's Black people themselves that start burying that story. Do you know, even in my own family, My father didn't know any of the stories that my grandmother told me. He didn't want to hear about it. I think because having grown up during the Jim Crow era, he had current issues, racial issues to deal with. Not everybody forgets where this started. And what does it do for me? I don't know. It makes me stronger because I stand on the head and shoulders of all the people who have gone before. And if I don't honor them, who is? Who tells their story?
Angie DeSilva is a professor of American Studies at Lindenwood College, and she's a historical reenactor and one of the organizers of the annual Mary Meacham Festival in St. Louis.